I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Not so long ago, the comic strip Dilbert became popular, depicting the claustrophobic cubicle culture at work. Now the open office design is becoming more popular, with more workplaces knocking down walls and removing dividers and doors in an attempt to foster more collaboration and innovation between coworkers. But do these open spaces really produce better results, or do we just end up annoying our colleagues, who now have to cope with all kinds of distractions, loud conversations, keyboard clicking, humming, the smells of leftovers for lunch, even mess? This hour, what kinds of designs and layouts make a better work environment? How does what we choose to display at our workspace reveal who we are? And later in the hour, how to make sure our desks and chairs are positioned correctly so we are not injuring ourselves. We begin with Ethan Bernstein, and he's an associate professor in organizational behavior at the Harvard Business School, joins us from their studios, and he just published an article entitled The Truth About Open Offices. And Ethan Bernstein, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Me too. Also with us is Mandy O'Neill. She's an associate professor of management, also senior scientist at the Center for the Advancement of Well-Being at George Mason University. And Mandy O'Neill, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. And let me make sure our listeners can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can also call us at 1-888-477-9499. And we already have a bunch of comments on our Facebook page, which I will read a bit later in the show. Ethan, let me begin with you and begin with this open office design. What was the original thinking behind the open office?
Oh, well, there are several reasons why open offices became what they are today. One of them was, as you described, our desire for more collaboration, more interaction, more collisions. I think that is a more modern explanation for them. The second, quite frankly, is cost. As you create more open spaces, you can fit more people in them. Density goes up, cost goes down.
You use the word collisions, which I just want to follow up on. I mean, the idea that we just bump into each other more often in an open space.
Exactly. So the idea that, gee, I'm the CEO and I really wish people in my organization had the conversation that would have allowed us to create that innovation as opposed to our competitors. And I know that two people in the organization, if they'd only talked, would have created that in-house. So if I can create a space, if I can create an architecture that would ultimately support that collision, it's not the accident that happens out in the front of the office building, hopefully, but instead something that actually creates something productive, then I've done good for the organization.
I mean, these seem lofty and in certain ways make sense. What, though, has been the impact of the open office design?
So our research suggests, and we've taken a very empirical look at this, we've tracked actual interaction collaboration patterns, that although the open office design is intended to encourage us to interact more face-to-face, it actually gives us permission not to.
Hmm. How so?
Well, I mean, at least from our research, we found specifically we tracked people as they moved from cubicled or more closed-off spaces into more open spaces. We tracked them face-to-face, their actual interaction. We tracked their electronic communication on IM and email and saw that the face-to-face interaction, as the same people moved from more closed spaces to more open spaces, went down by a rather large amount, by about 70% in multiple locations, different headquarters, different companies. And in place of that, electronic communication went up.
Hmm.
So very specifically, we substituted electronic communication for face-to-face communication when we faced a more open space.
I do want to pick up on that, but Mandy, let me get you in on the conversation. Do you think there are types of work environments where an open office space works?
Absolutely. I think this, I love this research, by the way, because for so long everybody's been wondering, and this work is some of the earliest and strongest empirical evidence, one way or the other. And what I'd like to add is that intentionality is so important, and also an understanding of the unintended consequences. Sometimes, you know, it gets annoying when social scientists say, it depends. But this is a great example where it really does depend on the type of work that's being done, the type of culture that the organization already has, and the type of what we sometimes call the aspirational culture, what they're trying to achieve, including what are the likely impacts on outcomes that matter for the organization. And so sometimes I think one of the dangers is that if we assume it's all good or all bad, then everybody tries to follow the trend without really understanding and having that intentionality of what they're trying to do, and then a really clear understanding, which we're starting to have now, of some of the unintended consequences of doing it.
So what kind of organizations, though, do you think that really would thrive under this more open space idea?
Yeah, so in some of my own research, I discovered this in an environment in which teamwork was very important. So this was a study of firefighters that Nancy Rothbard and I did and published in 2017, where one of the findings that didn't actually make a big splash in the paper was this unintended consequence of modernizing fire stations so that men and women could have separate facilities, so that people had a little bit of space so they could read and, you know, get some time away from these people that otherwise they spent 24/7 with. And so in doing the interviews with a lot of the staff, they reported that actually one of the unintended consequences of creating what would be not exactly an open office, but a much more open office in which people could hide from one another, is that they didn't get to know each other. And this getting to know each other was crucial for when they had to go out into an emergency and work as a team and really understand each other well, including each other's strengths and weaknesses. And so they used to complain about some of these outdated facilities where they were literally on top of each other all the time, what you might call sort of the early open office, and that there just wasn't space or facilities for people to even have separate male and female bathrooms. But again, unintentionally, creating all that extra space allowed people to hide. So they actually had, you know, an intervention to really get people out of their hiding spaces so they could learn about each other and really work together better as a team.
Ethan, let me go back to you, because we are, us human beings, we are social creatures, but we also do need and want some kind of privacy. So in an open office space, how do those, I guess, kind of tensions play out?
I give credit here to both work by Mandy and Nancy and others who've done fabulous work on how these interactions can ultimately become very human and beneficial as a result, but also to, I'll go in a completely different line of thinking here,
sure,
to thespians and actors out there. So I had an executive education student once who, after hearing some of my work on open offices, came to me and said, "Do you act?" And I said, "That's an interesting question to ask a professor." He said, "Because Diderot told us a long time ago that if you're going to set up on stage and try to create the intimacy that Mandy, to some extent, just referenced, you have to pretend that there is a fourth wall separating you from the audience, such that you would behave exactly as if the curtain had never risen." And to some extent, I think that's what happens in these open spaces to allow people to feel private, is that they create their own version of that fourth wall, and I guess in some cases the first, second, and third wall too. And they do that sometimes by putting, I mean, I've seen all kinds of office hacks these days, but there can be curtains, there can be headphones, there can even be blinders. Ethan Mollick, a professor at Wharton, sent me a tweet once about a Panasonic's new blinder. It's kind of like horse blinders that allow you to focus on your work.
Wow.
You can put up a picture that blocks vision. You can create privacy in all kinds of ways, which is really interesting, because ultimately what you do is you reconstruct the wall that you took away.
It's interesting, because I thought when you were talking about acting and thespians, that, I mean, that is so collaborative, and you do have to spend so much time together to create a play, but you're really talking about that interaction with the audience and that need for some kind of fourth wall.
And to Mandy's point, I completely agree that what you want is the people who are acting with each other, that team, to have the intimacy they need to have to do their work without the audience of everyone else around them getting in the way of them doing that work.
Well, let me go back to you, Mandy. And I think we all do this in some version at work, which is just we work with our colleagues, but we also need some kind of privacy to be able to get certain things done, about finding that balance between the two, and whether design can create problems that way or solve problems that way.
You know, it's just such a great question, because they can actually do both. And your point is so well taken about the need sometimes to have privacy. I actually love the blinders idea. I feel like I've wanted to use that in some of my shared spaces in the past. So 2 points there. One is the sort of idea that you can, you know, how do we create an environment where people can be comfortable? And it's not just the space, but you mentioned acting. I mean, one of the interventions I've worked with executives and companies is actually improv. So some of the tactics that use an improv, including playing, you know, and being able to react in the moment, create the kind of culture, and in particular what we call a culture of joviality, that allows you to embrace some of the frustrations that come with, for example, open office space or really any office space, but then to actually laugh about the frustrating parts instead of really ruminating about them and, you know, complaining to your spouse when you get home and then thinking about quitting because you just can't handle that guy singing anymore or that popcorn down the hall. And then at the same time, also recognizing the flip side of that, which is sometimes, you know, again, work can be very overwhelming, very frustrating, and you need some private space. And so we see all kinds of examples of this, but one of the ways I've seen it empirically is in hospitals, for example, where you're doing a lot of work with patient care, and some hospitals and some professional roles within hospitals have spaces where people can go and just, you know, be what we call offstage, again, to use that metaphor.
Sure.
So away from the customers, away from the clients, frankly, away from each other if they need to be, and sometimes to just, you know, let your hair down, to sigh, to meditate, to cry. I mean, these are not things that you want to do around a whole bunch of coworkers or clients. And so I've seen various versions of how offices give people that private space for really allowing themselves to kind of regulate their emotions or have some private time or even, for example, have calls that they just really don't feel comfortable with people having. It's one example where one open space I've worked with has actually used those old phone boxes that we used to use for, you know,
I was wondering
phones.
Where they ended up.
Yeah, well, they ended up in co-working spaces where people use them to make calls on their cell phones now, of course. But again, just to create a soundproof environment so that you don't have to have that call you really don't want everyone listening in anymore out in the open floor.
Ethan, I want to pick up on something you said earlier in about a minute before our first break here. You're saying in the open office design where there is more interaction, that people ended up texting more and emailing more. So while we have these human interactions, we kind of, our default mode is to go to digital.
Well, one thing open offices do is they allow the norms that Mandy's talking about to spread more quickly. We see what other people are doing, and so as a result, we do more of that. If we talk and or we bring tuna to the office or whatever it might be, as soon as we get the look from our colleagues, we stop doing that, and we do it some other way. So we don't bring tuna, and instead of talking, we email.
We don't bring tuna because it's smelly, right?
Exactly. Sorry, yes. I'm not trying to say something nasty about tuna
okay.
here. But these phone booths are a great example. These phone booths are just exploding. Companies, startups like Room in New York are creating these phone booths, and they're selling like hotcakes because people want a phone booth, not for the phone, but for the booth.
Interesting. Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. A bunch of comments I want to read as well. We are talking about office design, specifically the open office design. Ethan Bernstein is an associate professor in organizational behavior at the Harvard Business School. Mandy O'Neill is an associate professor of management and senior scientist at the Center for the Advancement of Well-Being at George Mason University. You can join our conversation. Any questions, comments, or anecdotes? We've got a lot of stories here. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, leave a comment on our Facebook page, and you can call us person to person, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking about office space design. And here's a scene from The Office. Oscar, played by Oscar Nunez, and Angela, played by Angela Kinsey, are arguing over Angela's jazz baby poster of two babies in fedoras playing saxophones. Now, Oscar is offended by it, and their boss, Michael Scott, played by Steve Carell, steps in to resolve the conflict.
Okay, so this is the disputed poster. Now, one at a time, I want you to express your feelings using I emotion language and no judging or you statements.
I got this poster for Christmas, and I feel I want to see it every day. It makes me feel like the babies are the true artists, and God has a really cute sense of humor.
Come on, seriously, that? I don't like looking at it. It's creepy and in bad taste, and it's just offensive to me.
It makes me think of the horrible, frigid stage mothers who forced the babies into it. It's kitsch. It's the opposite of art. It destroys art. It destroys souls. This is so much more offensive to me than hardcore porno.
Okay.
I love that clip. Mandy, we wanted to play that clip because some of the things that you have done in your research is just how we create and personalize our own workspace, you know, knowing, especially in an open office space, that most everyone's going to see it.
Yeah, I was actually on mute, so I wasn't laughing because I thought, oh, this is such a great example.
It is perfect.
You know, if I were to say how you could take it further, it's that, you know, either there's some kind of a policy, and you see that sometimes, but more often it's the culture, which is, you know, you go into some office place and nobody has a single personal picture, or you go into some and it's everybody's got their own. So there's the baby example, there's the, you know, political reference that's definitely offending, you know, half the population. And so how do you deal with situations in which you either have to have some kind of a, you know, a climate issue, which we call sort of a policy, practice, or procedure that says, for example, no personal space, or I actually prefer the cultural, you know, intervention, which is to say that what if we had the conversation and what if it wasn't so serious, but we could actually laugh about it and really, you know, talk about it with affection for each other. And so you saw how that conversation was going, where we're laughing, the audience, but I'm not sure the actual, imaginary office mates are laughing. But it could be a situation in which, you know, if you can laugh about it and laugh with affection, that is like, I like you, I care about you, I think your babies are creepy. And by the way, to be able to say that does suggest a level of psychological safety that we see in cultures where there is a lot of caring and affection, and combined with joviality tends to be sort of the optimal mix culturally.
And just a quick follow-up, does that have anything to do with open space design, or is it just more about how the culture gets created by the people who work there?
Well, it has a lot to do with it, because as we've talked about, in open space design, you are literally walking past someone's cubicle or someone's desk every single day. I mean, my favorite example is people singing. I mean, I just want to put it out there. Like, I'm anti-singing in the office. I don't care if you have a great voice.
Really?
It's just the likelihood that your style is going to not be, you know, either you don't have a great voice, your style is great, is sort of a thing. But, you know, we have a colleague that sings in the office, and we joke about it. We've had a conversation. So that's kind of an extreme example where if he wanted to sing in his office, we might still hear it. And we're lucky we still have offices with closed doors. But in an office space, there's no way to hide the singing, the popcorn. You know, maybe you can hide the baby picture if you sort of tucked it around the cubicle. But, yeah, open space exacerbates all of these differences that people have and how they choose to express themselves at work.
Ethan, let me read a couple of comments. One from Kyle. My experience is that open office plans definitely work. It prevents coworkers from streaming Netflix or Snapchatting. But then we've got Richard, who says open offices are too distracting and open to all the office drama. If they are as problematic as they are, why do we see more offices going to this open office design?
Well, I think those quotes suggest two reasons. One is not stated, which is cost. They are more cost effective. You simply get more people into the space. But we also, I think, have this hope, and we have to some extent understated what the field has done to respond to early open office designs, to respond to those concerns. So we have so-called hybrid, agile, flexible spaces of the sort that Mandy mentioned earlier, which still fall in with this open office category that we should talk about. And this these set of quotes give us the perfect opportunity to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Because you imagine those two people, just like your wonderful example, I also had you on mute so I wouldn't laugh too loud, trying to exist in the same space. And now you give them hybrid spaces where they can choose the area in which they think they can be most productive. And what they, of course, will do is they'll choose different spaces. And now what we have is people who are satisfied hanging out with people who would be satisfied by making the same choices that they would make. And now the diversity of perspective that you were hoping to get by having different people collide with one another in the office space isn't happening because they're each choosing the hybrid space that makes the most sense for them, like everyone else like them. And that's the problem that we haven't yet solved, I think, in open offices. And that's why That's why your question is a great one.
Well, here's Richard who says, I'm a white-collar worker sitting in a computer 8 hours a day. Workers are most often either in open offices seated 18 inches apart or crammed into offices a couple of feet away from others in a matter of hours. Every idiosyncrasy of each person is open knowledge. I mean, there's open offices, Ethan, and then there's just being piled on top of each other.
And yet, if the purpose of putting people close together is to create more spaces that are collaborative in which people can use the so-called free spaces, then maybe that's a trade-off we might be willing to make, except that free spaces are rarely free. And when you hang out in free spaces, people notice and do make other comments about you. Maybe you're streaming Netflix there. And so people don't – free space. The funny thing is you sit 18 inches from the person next to you and the free space is completely open and never used.
Here's a Facebook comment from Allison. I hate the open office. I'm actually an extrovert, but I don't want to chat with my coworkers or have those collaborative discussions because it will bother everyone else. I resorted to texting a coworker who's sitting 10 feet from me and who hasn't done that. But I'm wondering, Mandy, what about the introvert and the open office?
Actually, I'm so glad for your extroverted caller because I anchor the scale of extroversion. And I actually very much prefer private spaces in some ways to control my own tendencies, which is, you know, if there's someone down the hall, you know, they want to talk. Well, I am always game for talking. And so I think it's a really important point here where, you know, knowing yourself is very important. So first of all, even knowing extroversion and introversion and how you work best, but then realizing that sometimes you need to think a step ahead and say, you'd think that all the extroverts would want to hang out together, but whether you're the boss or the extrovert who just wants to get her work done, is that really the best environment? Or do you, again, back to this intentionality, do you create opportunities for extroverts to connect and brainstorm and come up with better ideas than they might if they were sitting in their office alone? And then do you also create opportunities where introverts have comfortable situations to come out and socialize with people but not get so overwhelmed by the bombardment of shallow, superficial conversations that can result, and by the way, are not actually the goal when we talk about, you know, this idea of, well, if they were just around each other, they'd come up with all these new ideas. But we know a thing or two about conversation patterns. And again, without really structuring them a bit or having some intentionality, that it's not necessarily the great ideas you'll be having. Instead, it could be something like venting about how much you can't stand one aspect of your work, or it could be talking about the weather or sports or kids or things that are great for actually, again, getting to know each other. But if the purpose is to have people together so they can brainstorm and come up with new innovations or work together better as a team, it's really important to think about the task that people are doing before just, again, assuming that open office is going to work A, for everybody, but B, for every task. Because again, even in the example of the extrovert, sometimes extroverts really need to rein it in and sit down and do concentrated work that benefits from not having people constantly interrupting them or distracting them or engaging them in conversations.
Let me just introduce the two of you. That's Mandy O'Neill, and she's a senior scientist at the Center for the Advancement of Well-Being at George Mason University. Ethan Bernstein joining us as well, and he's an associate professor of organizational behavior at the Harvard Business School. And we saw an article he wrote recently called The Truth About Open Offices and decided to build a show around that idea. You can send us an email, as others have, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Looks like everyone's got an opinion about today's topic. Ethan, let me go back to you. And even looking around where I work here, it's really a hybrid. There are offices with doors. There are cubicles. There are what I would describe as kind of half cubicles. There are open spaces. People are, you know, kind of on top of each other. It seems to me that most workplaces are kind of a mix of what we've been talking about.
And that's increasingly true, of course. No one is going all open or all closed. We're probably not going to go to the ultimate extremes, and we're probably not going back, for that matter, to private offices, just given where we are today in terms of portfolios. So our view in the Truth About Open Offices articles, co-authored with Ben Weber at Humanize, is that what we need to stop doing actually is talking about the architecture as if it's dispositive, and think about instead the anatomy of collaboration that happens inside of it. And that people will make choices about how they use a space to create the anatomy of collaboration, very similar to the cultural aspects that Mandy's talking about. And that if we can measure the anatomy, as opposed to just focusing instead on the architecture and what's built, mm-hmm. we'll make a lot more progress.
But if the goal is, let's say, more collaboration, more creativity, better productivity, and all the sort of buzzwords. How then, Ethan, I'll just go back to you, but Mandy as well, how then does a work environment create those opportunities where people don't feel so stressed and overwhelmed by all this openness?
So I guess here I'll be the one to say it depends. I'm going to agree with Mandy that it depends on the task. It depends on the people. We have the ability now with sensors in the workplace to see how people actually are interacting. Look at the current state. Conduct small experiments, whether they be with the architecture of the space or even with events or other means of actually deliberately creating interactions between individuals, perhaps face-to-face interactions, perhaps actually deliberately we want to create electronic interactions if the person who has the expertise for my question happens to be around the world. Mm-hmm. You don't want me asking that question to the person next to me. They'll give me an answer that won't be right. And so as we get better at, and perhaps this is the researcher in me speaking, better at empirically seeing how architecture breeds anatomy within a particular workplace, within a particular kind of task, then we can think more broadly about exactly what we want to put in place to intervene and create the collaboration we want.
Min, you want to add to that?
Yeah, so I have a couple of thoughts about that. One is, you know, you asked how we can create the collaboration, and we do have some evidence now, some empirical evidence, as well as just sort of, you know, pass the grandmother test wisdom of, for example, rituals like eating together. So Nancy and I discovered this in our firefighters, and some researchers at Cornell actually followed up and found that a ritual like having a group lunch can actually fulfill a lot of the benefits of getting to know each other, exchanging ideas in a more structured way and in a ritualistic way. I mean, there's this ancient notion of breaking bread, and I think that those ancient notions still play out today, where you can have people come together, have a lunch, and then go back to their work, sometimes in private environments. So I think that creating those rituals or those practices that allow the collaboration intentionally and with some sort of goal in mind can help versus just sort of let's stick everybody out there and, you know, see if it works out. And I want to echo another point that we were talking about earlier around this idea of having, you know, hybrid, but also giving people some choice in the matter and some autonomy and flexibility. So for this, I want to point to work that was done not so much in open offices, but in co-working spaces, some of which are very open, by Gretchen Spreitzer and Lyndon Garrett and Peter Basilis at Michigan Ross School, where they found that one of the great things about open offices in the co-working environment is that it gives people the choice of, today I really want to come in because, you know what, the work I'm doing would benefit from other people around, you know, maybe working for other startups and we can exchange ideas. But that when it becomes sort of a tyranny is when, and we know this from basic early studies of motivation, that giving people autonomy in how they do their jobs is a huge part of how they're motivated and ultimately how satisfied they are. So I think we can take that point to say that, you know, giving people a choice and really also recognizing that sometimes, you know, as Ethan pointed out earlier, you know, there's homophily, right? So all the social people will hang together. And is that great? You know, we know that too much cohesion can be a problem, but really allowing people some flexibility, even including on days when, you know what, this work I need to get done, maybe I could get to done that work at home. And then I could come into the open office space, for example, when I know that I'm doing something that would actually benefit from interacting with my coworkers.
Let me read a Facebook comment from Margaret. Then we'll get Elizabeth from Winco to join us. Margaret says, when I was first hired in the late 1960s, file clerks were still wearing roller skates and the paperwork for individual files were stitched together by a sewing machine. Just to put our conversation into some kind of context, we've got Elizabeth calling us from Winco. Elizabeth, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I worked in a company that had a complete open floor space, and it was downright creepy because certain activities that should have gone on behind a closed door were not. For example, someone was identified as needing coaching in their job. Everyone could see this identified coach going over to this person's cube, standing next to her and coaching her. I witnessed my supervisor's supervisor kneeling next to her at her cube, reprimanding her in a quiet voice, but I could still overhear it. And it was one of the reasons that contributed to me wanting to leave that job.
Wow. Well, those are really fascinating anecdotes, Elizabeth. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Ethan, is there then a need for a room, let's say, with this thing called a door, you know, so you can have some of those private conversations?
Oh, Elizabeth, I feel for you.
Yeah.
I've seen that. I've seen that all too often. And it comes from organizations, perhaps even with good intentions, putting people so close together and then not reinvesting the money they're saving in those kinds of spaces that you might have. With a door. Although once you put in a meeting room or several meeting rooms, then you have the meeting room tyrant who books the meeting room and then the rest of the meeting people don't show up and you just have a meeting of one person because you needed to have that space to yourself. And then, of course, the next step is you just work from home if you can. And that's the unfortunate thing. Collaboration is a team sport. And as soon as you start creating this sort of need for people to work from elsewhere or to hide, now the collaboration that you're trying to build with the space in the first place is not going to happen. Is there an answer? Mm. I honestly think the answer comes back to ask the collaborators how to make the collaboration happen. So ask the people, like Elizabeth, sitting in the space, how could we make this space work for us and run enough experiments to learn how to do it?
Let me read an email from Michael. He says, one of the best environments for me was a large team room with about 15 team members seated around two large tables in the center. Around the outside of the room were desks where people could move if they wanted to focus or disengage. But generally, we were all around the big tables working, talking, and generally enjoying our work. The walls separated us from the rest of the floor, the teams, and created a real sense of teamwork. And Mandy, that's really, when you talked about the firefighters, I think that gets to what Michael was saying there.
Absolutely. That's actually a really great idea where, for example, you might want the sales team, which, you know, tends to have a lot of extroverts and maybe they want to share tips and war stories and also ideas, have them off to a separate space, but really also make sure it's a soundproof space. I've seen that in some spaces where literally the sales team would be in a more open office and then the engineers or the writers or people who really need quiet, concentrated space would be in a separate place so they can do their work, which again gets to the point of what is the work we're trying to do, but also what is the culture we're trying to create. I mean, I was devastated hearing that story from Elizabeth about the supervisors, because it suggests that, you know, management in that case is really not engaging in enough perspective taking about how incidences like this might come off. And one of the things we know, for example, is that people, especially frontline individual contributors, are paying a lot of attention to managers and management, but the reverse is not true. So there's this asymmetry where everybody's watching middle managers as being exemplars of how to role model behaviors, and really we need to pay attention to that as middle managers.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We've got a third guest who will be joining us in just a couple of minutes. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we're going to spend just a minute or two talking more about the open office design and also how to create office spaces that do allow for both collaboration but also some degree of privacy. Mandy, I want to go back to you, and just briefly, if you don't mind, you did some interesting research looking at the designs of tables in office spaces, and one of our listeners reminded me of some of that research that you did, the square table, the round table.
Yeah, this was one of the most fascinating observations doing an ethnographic study of a co-working space, which is that, you know, they were really reading the literature deeply. So all these studies we're doing, you know, there's people out there reading them and trying to implement it. So one of the unexpected things that they discovered is that at the time there hadn't been any research on what about the furniture? Well, there was research, and I think we'll talk about it, but they had this fascinating observation that they had two rooms for small group meetings, and one was a square table, and one was a rectangular table. And just like Ethan was describing, people had to book these rooms, and what they discovered is that no, because they looked at the pattern of room bookings, and they discovered no one was booking the room with the square table. And they said, well, why is this? And this is a good example of why, you know, qualitative interview technique is helpful. They just asked people, and they said, oh, well, because it really freaks us out that there's no head of the table. And they thought that was so fascinating. They said, well, that's the idea, right? We're trying to create more egalitarian teams. They said, oh, heck no. We need to know who's in charge of this meeting. We need a head of the table. And I thought that was such an interesting insight that taps into our basic human needs for status hierarchies, including which table we choose based on how we can easily sort that out from the table perspective.
Ethan, final thoughts and anything you want to say in response to Mandy's table research?
Which it's just so interesting. We mentioned in our article the example of Mori Buildings in Japan, who've done a number of experiments around how to make their space more collaborative. And they've found that if you make a table too big, just like a dining room table, no one can actually have a single conversation, and therefore they don't really have one at all. And so all of these, like all of these micro moments of change in office space give us a chance to improve the conversation we're having right now, which I think is what our next guest is going to help us think about.
Well, what a perfect segue. Ethan Bernstein, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's an associate professor of organizational behavior at the Harvard Business School. And Mandy O'Neill, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you so much. This is so fun.
So fun and really instructive. She's a senior scientist at the Center for the Advancement of Well-Being at George Mason University. Let me read one more email before we get our third guest in on the conversation, who says, it's been years since I worked in an open space, but it was horrible. It was so noisy. It was hard to think. And I had a coworker next to me who spent hours on the phone on personal calls. I told my boss I needed an office or I would lose my mind. And she ends by saying, I got the office. Well, let me get Jack Dinnerline to join us. He's a professor in the Bouvet College of Health Science at Northeastern University. He studies ergonomics and safety, and he's also associate director of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health's Center for Work Health and Well-Being. He happens to be in Philadelphia at a conference about work stress and health. And Jack Dinnerline, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And again, we are talking now more about things like standing desks and sitting desks and ergonomics. So you can join the conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Would you say, broadly speaking, Jack, that our offices, the way they're designed and the way our desks and chairs are kind of hazardous to our health?
Well, yeah. What we've known for probably since the 90s, when the desktop computer sort of came into the office environment, that, you know, the desk as it is, and with that computer, all of a sudden we became very constrained in our postures and as a result, a lot of musculoskeletal disorders started coming out. People talk about carpal tunnel syndrome, but that's not really the major issue. It's more tendonitis, shoulder pain, neck pain, elbow pain, and even back pain started happening in the office environment as a result of sort of the constrained postures of sitting all the time. And that's sort of what the epidemiology in the late 90s and even into this century has shown, that constrained posture for a long period of time is not great for our musculoskeletal health.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things. Are you saying that our desks, the height of our desks, are not designed for us if we're on a computer?
Yeah, what happened when the computer revolution happened in the late 80s and 90s was we just put desktop computers on top of old-fashioned desks. And what we realized was that was a little too high. A lot of these standard desks are too high, and so we have to raise up our arms and shoulders to match the keyboard and the mouse. And as a result, that put a lot of extra strain on the neck and shoulders. So there was a high rate of shoulder and neck pain among office workers that we saw. And so that mismatch has been identified as a major problem. So a lot of ergonomists come in and, you know, talk about this idea of adjustability in the workstation and trying to get the height of the desk to sort of match the worker. And when we think about ergonomics, it's this idea of, you know, how do you match the physical work environment with the physical capabilities of the worker? And that kind of that height was a major issue around around desktop computers and the desks themselves.
So how do we know if the desk that we're working is the right height? Is it, if we're in pain, it probably is not?
That's right. And in fact, one of the things that we've done in our group is we've looked at, you know, giving people adjustable furniture and seeing where do they find comfort. And one of the things what I find interesting is that not everybody finds comfort in the same place. You know, there's a lot of recommendations for the 90-90 posture, which makes a lot of sense, and it's a good place to start to set up your workstation. That is where your legs are horizontal and your feet are flat on the ground and your elbows are horizontal when they're relaxed. So if the height of the table is sort of matching your elbow height when you're relaxed, that's really a good place to start. And then sort of keep moving it around and adjusting it. Some of the work we've done shows that, you know, people sometimes like a little bit lower, some people like a little bit higher. It all depends on their style of work and what they're doing. It gets back to some of the conversation earlier you had about it really depends on what the task is,
sure,
of what people are doing and sort of moving things around like that.
One of the engineers this morning stopped me in the hallway and said, okay, are you going to be able to solve the pressing question whether a standing desk is better than a sitting desk? Can you do that, Jack?
Yeah, so standing, so there's two types of things. There's sort of the fixed desk and fifth, you know, whether you're fixed sitting or standing. And both of those aren't good by themselves all the time. And I think that's sort of an important thing to state. But the idea of having an adjustable sit-stand workstation, those are really showing a lot of promise around around the world in terms of thinking about, they add a lot of variability to the way you can do your work. And so from task to task, you can change what you're doing. For example, when I'm often doing email, I'll stand up and I write shorter emails, and I spend less time writing those emails when I'm standing up because I'm thinking and I'm moving. But sometimes if I'm doing a lot of more cognitive writing around, you know, doing a research paper or something, I'll sit down and, you know, because I'm going to be there for a longer period of time. And so that mixture, what our research has also shown is that when you stand, you actually take a different posture. And it gets back to that comment I made before about the fact that, you know, when we started sitting at computers, our postures really became constrained. And by having this variable sit-stand workstation, we're allowed to change our postures and actually start changing that posture and relieving our shoulders and neck and making things better. The issue, though, is that standing, you know, there's a comment out there that sitting's the new cancer or the new smoking out there. Well, we have to remember standing's the old one in the workplace. And people who stand for a profession, they have a lot of health issues. They have a lot of cardiovascular disease. They also have a lot of low back pain.
Well, I'm thinking about people like factory workers that probably have to stand pretty much all day. But I'm also thinking the fact that most workplaces are not investing the whatever hundreds of dollars into sit-stand desks. So if that is not what you have at your desk, is it just make more sense to get up and every hour or so and just walk around?
Absolutely. I mean, if you can get up and move around, that's really healthy. Some other research that we've done and others in Europe has shown is that when you're away from your desk, your posture is varying a lot. So you're actually your shoulders are moving, your wrists are moving. Things are a lot better in terms of your musculoskeletal health. And so moving around is really helpful. You know, we were talking about the design of the office space before. Putting printers far away is helpful because then you have to walk to the printer when you get your printer, not instead of having it right next to your desk. And some of these active offices where you do have to move around to get to different people or to talk to folks, that can help. Having the coffee machine down the hall, having the water bubbler, having the bathroom down the hall is really helpful. And another big thing that I always talk about is that in my class is thinking about drinking a lot more water because then you do have to get up more.
So two good things to do, a little activity and a little water on top of that. I'm also thinking about lighting in offices. I mean, some offices have wonderful natural light, others not so much.
Right.
Is there a healthy way to think about lighting in the office?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the idea of natural light is always so key. I mean, our bodies are designed around natural light. And so, you know, our circadian rhythm, our sleep, our performance is so related to the type of light that we get. And there's been lots of studies looking at that. In terms of the office environment, you know, if you can get more natural light into the office and into the open, into the depths of the office, that's great because it can really help people stay awake and alert. That's the most fundamental idea, but it also increases productivity a little bit. The type of lighting, if you don't have natural light, then, you know, a lot of offices go, it really depends on the task going on. And one big thing is thinking about indirect light versus task light. So in the general office, having sort of lots of indirect light, no sort of, you know, that reduces glare, and then having nice lights right where you're working to light up the workstation themselves.
I'm also thinking, and I was reading some reports about that in having to do with temperature at work, and that women tend to be colder at work, or they want things a little bit warmer at work than men. Is there a way to find a happy medium?
that's, it gets back to that, the different types of, back to the open office environment discussion that was just happening of like, who's going to be in the office, who's going to be there, and actually having control, who's going to have control over that work that work temperature, and who sort of sets that, and how do you come up to consensus of how are we going to make that decision as a group. And there's actually been some work by another colleague of mine who looked at just giving a thermostat on the on each person's wall made them feel happier, even though they had no, didn't do anything. They could go up and change the temperature, and that seemed to work. I really think that's a hard problem to solve. It gets back to what your guest Ethan was talking about in terms of the issues of how do you sort of come to a consensus for everybody around that. So, but yeah, there is the physiology difference in the psychophysics of how men and women perceive the temperature differently, and even gets to clothing.
And even gets to clothing as well. I know women, myself included, often have sweaters at work because it's always so cold.
Yes.
One of the callers had a question about flooring, saying that hard floors hurt his feet. Carpeting really made a difference and made him more comfortable. How significant is that?
In manufacturing and standing work, the what people stand on does seem to matter. And there's lots of different approaches that people have taken, from having mats on the floor to wearing different types of shoes. It can be either in the environment or in your own clothes that you wear. So that there is a lot of evidence from the literature describing this idea of that the flooring does matter. We know it matters for locomotion, in terms of how well people run and things like that. And so it would make sense that it applies to the workplace as well.
I'm thinking about those people, though, that are literally on their feet all day. What do you recommend?
Take a break. It gets back to the office. It's like, the office people need to take a break from sitting all the time. The same is true for standing people, is like, find a place where you can, sit down. And even this idea, in Europe, you look at grocery clerks, they actually have these sit stands, what they call perching chairs, which they allow them to sort of stay upright close to interacting with the customer, actually another word for it, stool, where they can actually take a load off from the feet. The other thing is, having foot rails at a standing workstation, so you can sort of take some time, unload one foot at a time and just sort of change things up. But if you can take those breaks just as much as you can for a sitting environment, that's really helpful too.
Final question, about 30 seconds. One of our listeners says, are treadmill desks worth it? The idea that the ones where you're walking very slowly and working?
Yeah, so in terms of, this idea of sedentariness at the in the office, treadmills appear to be the only thing that really actually increases energy expenditure when you're working. A standing desk doesn't really do too much in terms of increasing your physical activity in the workplace. It allows you to do more physical activity because you can walk around and stuff. But the actual desk doesn't make any difference in terms of the calorie expenditure. In fact, it's equivalent to a slice of bread for a whole day. If you stood for a whole day versus sitting, it's equivalent to a slice of bread.
Jack, I hate to do this, but we do have to end our conversation. We're running out of time, and I thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. And that's Jack Dennerlein, professor of health science at Northeastern University. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and we do want to close things out with a clip from the copy machine guy at Saturday Night Live, sitting by the copy machine making up names for people who come in to make copies.
Steve and Sandy, making copies. The Steve Man and the Sandster, making copies.
Who is this guy? Do you know him?
Don't worry about him. That's just Richard Lamer. It's just his way of trying to be nice. Hi, Richard.
The Sandster saying hi. Sandy and Steve.
It's kind of annoying. Maybe somebody ought to talk to him.
Steve-a-rama. Steve-a-ramovich.
We've all tried. There's nothing we can do. Thank you.
All right. Steve-o's finished with the copies. Sandy's turn. Sandita.
Hey, guy. What are you working on here?
Steve Areno!
You work for the accounting department, I guess, huh?
Steve-o!
So how do you like it here?
All right, Steve Rolo, the Steve Meister, asking me questions.
Well, I gotta finish my report. I'll see you later. Richard, the Ritzmeister!
Yeah, making friends with the Stevenator.
I think there's another copy machine on this floor.
Okay.
Steve-o, leaving the room, walking away.